Good morning. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind Radio. The Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information, located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. The Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This morning, I'm Jane, and I'll be reading to you from the Sentinel and Enterprise and possibly the Saturday edition of the Lowell Sun. Dorothy will not be with us for a few weeks, but we're anticipating her coming back. And she's fine. It's just a few situations at home that she needs to be away. Now, the Lowell Association for the Blind would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Now, from the Saturday edition of the Lowell Sun, here we go. Highly suggestive of a cover-up. Withheld state police crash video sparks contempt motion in Fahn murder case. The discovery fight in the Fahn murder case determined the case continued this week after a defense attorney accused the state police of possibly hiding crucial video from the fatal 2023 cruiser crash caused by Sergeant Scott Quigley and misleading the court about what evidence actually existed. In a motion filed Thursday, attorney William Dolan, who represents Chana Fahn, one of the three Lowell brothers charged with the first-degree murder, asked a Middlesex Superior Court justice to cite the state police or its attorney for the contempt. Dolan argued the agency either failed to conduct a diligent search for crash-related records or intentionally withheld cruiser camera footage showing troopers trading candid remarks about Quigley's condition and suggesting higher-ups did not want him questioned in the immediate aftermath of the crash. As a homicide investigator assigned to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, Quigley played a central role in the Fahn murder investigation, which has raised questions for the defense of prosecutorial misconduct. The footage that was withheld from the defendants in this case is highly suggestive of a cover-up from the MSP, Dolan stated in the motion. It is incredibly concerning that this particular information was not provided. The motion is asking the court to impose a $100 fine and to order the state police and Middlesex District Attorney's Office to conduct a new comprehensive search for all materials connected to the crash. The motion was triggered by a publication that appeared in the Boston Herald and the Sun regarding previously unseen cruiser camera footage from the night Quigley's unmarked cruiser crossed into the oncoming traffic in Woburn and struck the van carrying Angelo Schettino, a 37-year-old special needs man who died a month later. The footage, which the state police had not provided to the defense, captured troopers talking about the delay in interviewing Quigley at Lahey Hospital following the brutal head-on collision and speculating on his condition. One officer is heard saying, "Unless he's blah, blah, blah faced, I'm not worried about it," while Sergeant Jennifer Penton, assigned to investigate the crash, told another trooper, "They don't even want me to come, like I'm not freaking IA Internal Affairs. They're looking out for him," Penton said in the footage. "Maybe they know it was his fault, and they're like, whoa, 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 let's just wait." Penton relayed that a lieutenant instructed her that right now is not the time for an interview, despite being assigned to investigate the crash. The footage further includes Penton stating, it appears that Scott had his phone out. She ultimately did not interview Quigley until 8 days after the wreck. Quigley ended up receiving only a marked lane violation. Accusations that Quigley's blood alcohol level tested at .114 at the hospital following the crash above the legal limit of .08 came out in a wrongful death suit filed by Schettino's mother, which is pending in Essex Superior Court. According to Dolan's motion, a state police attorney, Shoban Kelly, told the court on February 2nd that the agency had performed a diligent search and turned over all records related to the crash. He argues that statement was not accurate. The timing of the subsequent release of footage by the state police late Thursday afternoon raised further suspicion from Dolan. While Dolan was on a local radio show at approximately 3:05 p.m., stating that he had not seen or received the footage, the state police provided the defense with a link to the video. Shortly after that, Dolan learned that the Middlesex District Attorney's Office had filed an emergency motion to compel discovery from the state police, specifically referencing the footage highlighted in the article released by the Boston Herald and the Lowell Sun. The emergency motion tells the court that the state police had failed to comply with a January 30th discovery order requiring a production of all dash cam and other recordings from troopers who responded to Quigley's crash. In the filing, prosecutors wrote that the footage surely should have been provided pursuant to the court's discovery order. The motion emphasizes that the state police, as an organization, is not part of the prosecution team, but prosecutors say they nonetheless have an ethical obligation to ensure that potentially favorable information to the defense is disclosed as soon as possible. Prosecutors asked the judge to order the state police to comply with the court's discovery order and deliver the above-referenced material to the court immediately. On Friday, Dolan questioned why an emergency motion from the Middlesex District Attorney's Office was necessary if the state police had already released the footage referenced in the article. He proposed maybe the prosecutors were not aware of the footage and had been provided at the time they filed the motion, but argued they must be aware by now, arguing they should have withdrawn the motion on Friday. What I think they're doing, Dolan said about the prosecution, isn't a legal emergency, it's a public relations emergency. That motion is moot because the state police already put out that footage. They're just looking to put on a show. However, Megan Kelly, a spokesman for the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, said late Friday afternoon that the emergency motion was in fact filed before the state police released the missing footage, contradicting Dolan's characterization of the timeline. The motion will be addressed during a hearing in Middlesex Superior Court in Lowell at 2 p.m. on Tuesday. That's this afternoon. The fatal crash has already set off multiple investigations. The state police have opened internal affair cases and hired an outside firm to review the agency's handling of the incident. The Suffolk County District Attorney's Office is weighing whether Quigley, who has been suspended without pay, should face criminal charges after the Middlesex District Attorney's Office recused itself from the case. Quigley's involvement in the crash and the alleged cover-up has also halted the Farn brothers' murder retrial. All three Farn brothers are charged with first-degree murder for allegedly gunning down 22-year-old Tyrone Fett in September 2020 as he sat in his car outside his apartment on Spring Avenue in Lowell. The Farn brothers' first trial in November 2024 ended in a mistrial after the jury failed to reach a unanimous verdict. The retrial is currently scheduled to take place in Middlesex Superior Court on April 27th. Meanwhile, Penton is suspended with pay in an unrelated case involving the 2024 death of a state police recruit. She has been charged with manslaughter and perjury for allegedly lying to the grand jury. Wow. I mean, I'm telling you, this just goes on and on and on. All right, let's see if I can't get my iPad to go the way I want it to go, but hold on next. Okay, now let's see. All right, let's go to the Sentinel and Enterprise, and this is what we should be looking at today. All right, now this is from Worcester. The theater announces inaugural playwright in residence. Okay, the Hanover Theater Repertory, the THT rep named Call Me Izzy star, an Emmy-winning CBS correspondent Jamie Wax, as its inaugural playwright-in-residence, marking a new investment in developing original work within the region and creating world-class theater in Worcester. Let's see. So we'll go back again. They have named Jamie Wax to be his playwright-in-residence. Over the course of the four-week residency, Wax utilized the company's creative resources for focused writing time while collaborating in the room with artists, according to a press release. The residency culminates this coming Friday and Sunday, March 6th and 8th, at the Brick Box Theater, located inside the Gene McDonough Arts Center on 20 Franklin Street, with stage readings of his new play centered on three high-risk expectant mothers and two overworked nurses in the maternity wing of the newly integrated Louisiana Hospital. The readings will feature his Doubt castmate and Broadway actor Joanna Day, and give area audiences an early look at work and development. The initiative reflects THT Rep's broader commitment to strengthening the regional arts ecosystem by attracting talent, creating professional opportunities, and presenting new work locally rather than solely in larger coastal markets. In other words, the Hanover Theater is welcoming Saturday Night Live and MTV's cult favorite game show Remote Control veteran Colin Quinn to Tuckerman Hall, 10 Tuckerman Street on Saturday, March 7th at 7 p.m. A seasoned stand-up comedian, actor, and author from Brooklyn, Quinn has been part of your whole life, even though you never asked for it. Also coming up is Bat Out of Hell, the musical at the Hanover Theater, 2 Southbridge Street, for one night only on Thursday, April 23rd at 7:30 p.m. The legendary and award-winning Jim Steinman incorporated iconic songs from Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell albums, including You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, Bat Out of Hell, I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, It's All Coming Back to Me, and 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad, into an epic rock and roll musical featuring world-class singers, cast of singers, dancers, and actors, accompanied by a dynamic 8-piece rock band. That sounds pretty interesting. In addition, tickets are now on sale for America's Got Talent finalist Gina Brilliant's performance at the Brick Box Theater on May 8th. Known for her high-energy, culture-spanning humor that tackles family, identity, and everyday life with warmth and razor-sharp wit, her laser special, Mind Your Business, premiered this year and quickly surpassed 250,000 viewers. For a more full schedule, more information, and to purchase tickets, visit the HanoverTheater.org. It sounds like a very interesting spring coming out. All right, let's see. Now we're going to go about to the sad case of affairs. War in the Mideast widens as Trump says strikes on Iran could last several weeks. Dubai, United Emirates. This is from there. Israel and the United States pounded Iran on Monday in a campaign that U.S. President Donald Trump said would likely take several weeks. Tehran and his allies hit back against Israel, Gulf states, and targets critical to the world's energy problem. Production. The intensity of the attacks, the killing of Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, and the lack of any apparent exit plan set the stage for a prolonged conflict with far-reaching consequences. Safe havens in the Middle East, like Dubai, have seen incoming fire. Hundreds of thousands of airline passengers are stranded around the globe. Oil prices shot up, and U.S. allies pledged to stop Iranian missiles and drones. With no sign of the conflict abating any time soon, Trump said operations are likely to last 4 to 5 weeks, but he was prepared to go far longer than that. In a sign of concern over the potential for spiraling violence, the State Department on Monday urged U.S. citizens to leave more than a dozen Middle Eastern countries due to safety risks. The hardest hits are yet to come from the U.S. military, say Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters. The next phase will be even more punishing on Iran than it is right now. Trump has said U.S. forces were determined to destroy Iran's missile capabilities, wipe out its navy, prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and ensure that it cannot continue to support allied groups like Lebanon's Hezbollah, which fired missiles at Israel on Monday, drawing retaliatory airstrikes. The chaos of the conflict became apparent when U.S. military aides said, Kuwait had mistakenly shot down three American F-15 Strike Eagles while Iran was attacking with aircraft, ballistic missiles, and drones. U.S. Central Command said all six pilots ejected safely and are in stable condition. As several airstrikes hit Iran's capital, Tehran, the top security official, Ali Larijani, wooed on X, "We will not negotiate with the U.S. Iran expands attacks to regional energy facilities. World markets rattled as the fighting expanded across a region vital to energy supplies. Saudi Arabia's Ras Tanura oil refinery came under attack from drones, but its defenses downed the incoming aircraft, a military spokesman told the state-run Saudi press agency. The refinery has a capacity over 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day. The attack on Saudi Arabia's Ras Tanura refinery marks a significant escalation with Gulf energy infrastructure now squarely in Iran's sights, said Torbjorn Solvet, an analyst at the risk intelligence company Verus Maplecroft. The Gulf state of Qatar said its Air Force shot down two Iranian Suki Su-24 bombers, and Qatar Energy said it would stop producing liquefied natural gas indefinitely, taking one of the world's top suppliers off the market. European natural gas prices surged by 40% in response. Several ships have been attacked in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow mouth of the Persian Gulf, through which a fifth of all oil traded passes and where Iran threatened attacks. The Gulf is also a hub for air travel, and passengers have been stranded around the world as carriers base their grounded flights. Long-haul carriers Etihad and Emirates restarted limited flights Monday. Iran said nuclear site was targeted. Reza Navai, Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, told reporters that airstrike targeted Natanz nuclear enrichment site on Sunday. Their justification that Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons is simply a big lie, he said. Israel and the U.S. have not acknowledged strikes at the site, which the U.S. bombed in the 12-day war between Iran and Israel in June. Israel had said it's targeting the leadership in nuclear infrastructure. Iran has said it's not enriched uranium since June, though it has maintained the right to do so while saying its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. The death toll grew on all sides. The Iranian Red Crescent Society said the U.S.-Israeli operation has killed at least 555 people. In Israel, where several locations were hit by Iranian missiles, 11 people were killed. Israel's retaliatory strikes against Hezbollah killed dozens of people in Lebanon. The U.S. military announced that previously unaccounted for American service members have been confirmed, that two previously unaccounted have been confirmed dead, bringing the total to six. Three people were reported killed in the United Arab Emirates and one each in Kuwait and Bahrain. Iran's top diplomat on Monday shared an aerial photo showing rows of graves that he said were for more than 160 girls killed during a U.S.-Israeli strike on an elementary school in Minab. Their bodies were torn to shreds, Abba Aragachi, the country's foreign minister, said on X. In Israel, three young siblings killed by an Iranian strike were being laid to rest at the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem on Monday night. Yaakov, 16, Avigail, 15, and Sarah, 13, were among the nine killed when a missile slammed into a shelter located in a synagogue in Beit Shemesh. Hezbollah fires on Israel, prompting massive response. Hezbollah said it's fired missiles on Israel early Monday in response to Khamenei's killing and repeated Israeli aggressions. It was the first time in more than a year that the militant group has claimed an attack. Israel retaliated with strikes on Lebanon. The country's health ministry reported at least 52 people killed and 154 wounded in overnight strikes in the Beirut suburbs in southern Lebanon. Associated Press journalists in Beirut were jolted awake by loud explosions that shook the buildings and shattered windows. Lieutenant General Ayel Zamir, the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, said the military would not end its offensive against Hezbollah before the threat from Lebanon is eliminated. Did I read? Okay. Israeli military said it had completed a wave of strikes targeting branches of Al-Quad Al-Hassan, a charity operating outside the Lebanese financial system that Israel said is used to fund Hezbollah's military wing. An Israeli airstrike in Beirut is heavily damaged a building, as the military said it targeted a senior Hezbollah official. The U.S. military, which has used B-2 stealth bombers to strike Iran's ballistic missile facilities with 2,000 Bahound bombs, said Monday it had taken out 11 Iranian warships. Trump said the Iranian Navy's headquarters had been largely destroyed. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters Monday that the U.S. is not engaged in a nation-building effort in Iran. This is not Iraq. This is not endless. Danny Danon, an Israeli ambassador to the U.N., said the conflict will continue as long as it takes. An Israeli military spokesman, Brigadier General Effie Defron, said Israel is keeping all options on the table, including a possible ground invasion of Lebanon. it is not completely clear what the U.S. objectives are. In announcing the initial strikes, Trump referred to the threat posed by Iran's nuclear and missile program, a point echoed Monday by Rubio, who said the purpose of the mission was to destroy the country's capabilities and prevent any redevelopment. Trump also listed various grievances dating to Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and urged Iranians to take over their government. There have been no signs yet of any such uprising. Trump, however, also signaled he would be open to dialogue with Iran's new leadership, which could be chosen soon. Tehran's streets have been largely deserted with people sheltering during airstrikes. The paramilitary Bazi force, which has played a central role in crushing recent nationwide protests, set up checkpoints across the city. In the northern Iranian city of Babol, a student speaking anonymously over concerns of retribution told AP that the armed riot police were on the streets Saturday night and into the early hours of Sunday after the death of Khomeini. We don't know whether to be happy about the elimination of the criminals who oppress us or to remain silent in the face of the U.S. and Israeli war against the country and its interest in the terror that is taking place, he said. Now, Lidman reported from Tel Aviv, Israel, and Magdi from Cairo, Associated Press writers Basen Mu and Sally Abu Aju in Beirut and Susan Frazier in Ankara, Turkey, contributed to this report. So that, and we just hope that this is a very, very short war. Now we're going to talk about, let's see, this is from the State House. Focus on fraud has Attorney General girding for another lawsuit. And this is from Boston. Attorney General Andrea Campbell said she's prepared to lodge yet another lawsuit against the federal government should the Trump administration crack down on Medicaid fraud in Minnesota shift focus to Massachusetts, where public benefits fraud is getting fresh attention. President Donald Trump hinted at a looming clash last week when he put a spotlight on fraud in Massachusetts and another Democratic-led states during his State of the Union address. Federal officials last week paused $259.5 million in quarterly Medicaid matching funds in Minnesota to prevent payment of questionable claims while further investigation is completed. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said it may withhold up to $1 billion over the next year should Minnesota fail to clean up its significant program integrity vulnerabilities or demonstrate that the expenditures are allowable. During a television interview that aired Sunday, Campbell was asked whether a similar Medicaid funding freeze could unfold here. MassHealth, the state's Medicaid program, accounts for nearly one-third of the budget. Well, if they come for our resources, we will file suit like we have been, Campbell said on WCVB's On the Record program. The AG said her office has filed nearly 50 lawsuits against the Trump administration in hopes of protecting more than $3 billion. The Senate Republicans in Massachusetts recently called for an oversight hearing into public benefit fraud in the SNAP program. In their request to Senate Committee on Post-Audit and Oversight Chairman Mark Buttigieg, the Senate GOP caucus pointed to $34 million in public health benefit fraud identified by Auditor Diana DeSoglio's office over a three-year period, as well as two cases brought by U.S. Attorney Leah Foley. In fiscal 2025 alone, the Bureau of Special Investigations within DeSoglio's office identified roughly $12 million in public benefit fraud. Nearly half of that figure was attributed to MassHealth. DiSaglio's Medicaid audit unit last week released a report identifying nearly $8.5 million in potential cost savings at MassHealth based on probes into dental services, transportation services, durable medical equipment, providers, and inpatient maternity services. MassHealth paid about $521,500 for DME that could not be verified as having been audited by an eligible provider, and for about $31,700 for DME audited by providers who are excluded from MassHealth. The report said MassHealth also paid providers $27,400 for equipment audited for deceased members. MassHealth said it plans to investigate the report's claims and recoup overpayments, and the agency said it offers training for providers to comply with state and federal laws, according to the report. MassHealth emphasized that due to the delay in how it receives information about deceased members, it relies on the post-pay process to recoup payments for its members who had passed away, the report continued. Trump discussed fraud allegations in Minnesota during his State of the Union address when he declared a war on fraud, and he also name-dropped Massachusetts. California, Massachusetts, Maine, and many other states are even worse, Trump said. This is the kind of corruption that shreds the fabric of a nation, and we are working on it like you wouldn't believe. Campbell said Trump called out those states as part of a blueprint to weaponize the federal government across Democratic strongholds. Governor Maura Healey proposed a $3.5 million increase for the AG's office in fiscal 2027. Campbell is seeking an additional $2.7 million to keep up with the federal legal battles and to tackle accountability voids she sees in Washington. They're not doing some of the public health work we're doing, or the health care work, or the Medicaid fraud we're doing, Campbell said. So we have to fill the gap. That means I have to expand my team in order to ensure that folks here in Massachusetts are not defrauded. And this was written by Allison Kuznets. She's a reporter for the State House News and State Affairs Pro Massachusetts. And now we're going to do, okay, Sky Meadow shooting. Suspect told police he wanted to punish the wealthy. And this is from Nashua. Hunter Nadeau allegedly told police he had been in his Nashua apartment all day September 20th when he suddenly had a feeling he wanted to kill himself. An affidavit from the Nashua Police Department goes on to state that Nadeau had grabbed his 380 caliber Glock 42 pistol, two extra magazines of ammunition, a knife, and a bag containing a change of clothes before leaving his home to carry out what would become a deadly shooting at Nashua's Sky Meadow Country Club. The affidavit, unsealed on February 23rd by Judge Andrew Shulman in Hillsbury Superior Court Southern District, lays out what investigators said happened before, during, and after the attack, and the motive Nadeau allegedly described to police, including a desire to punish the elites. Surveillance video captured Nadeau, who was 23 at the time, entering the club at 7:17 p.m., wearing a black hooded jacket, glasses, and a green backpack. The affidavit states he walked into the club's restaurant, Prime, at Sky Meadow, where he put on a face mask, pulled out a handgun, and fired shots at employee Steve Burtman, the food and beverage manager who was stationed at the front desk outside the restaurant. Burtman, a Chelmsford native and Lowell resident, was struck in the face by the gunfire and fell to the ground. From there, the affidavit said, Nadeau entered the doors of the restaurant and opened fire at multiple patrons. One of those patrons, 59-year-old Robert Stephen de Sazeri of Nashua, was killed, while Brianna Surrett of Lynn was wounded. Nadeau continued to shoot until he was attacked by other patrons in the restaurant, and he retreated back through the doors of the steakhouse, the affidavit states. After responding to the scene, police found Nadeau in the area of the club's golf course, bleeding from an apparent self-inflicted incised wounds to his arms and wrists. He is alleged to have told police he was a bad guy. Nadeau was detained without incident and taken to a hospital for treatment, where he willingly spoke to police about the incident. According to the affidavit, Nadeau immediately identified himself as the shooter. He told police that although he initially left home intending to kill himself, he then decided to punish the wealthy because they're not helping the poor, stating that he was tired of the elites taking all the money. He said he chose Sky Meadow Country Club because he had worked there about a year earlier as a server and knew that you had to have money to have a membership there. According to the affidavit, Nadeau said he deliberately avoided the wedding taking place on the property because he did not want to target civilians, and instead into the restaurant because he knew that it was members only and only wealthy people dined there. Inside, he said he just started shooting. He was not targeting a specific person, but did not care whether he killed someone or not, and knew that if he shot in a crowded restaurant, he would kill somebody, the affidavit said. He is also alleged to have said he was unsure about how many rounds he fired. He remembered being tackled from behind and said he left his gun behind in the restaurant when he fled. Nadeau also told police he ditched his backpack in the woods and walked out on the golf course and slit his wrists, hoping to die. He further stated that he had written a note describing his intention in a composition book left in his apartment, told no one about his plan, and did not discuss it on social media. He confirmed he was the only shooter and that the firearm was the only one he possessed. Nadeau, who was 23 at the time of the shooting and turned 24 in January, was indicted by a grand jury on alternative counts of purposeful first-degree murder and reckless second-degree murder for the death of de Cesare, who was dining with family when he was gunned down. Nadeau also faces two counts of attempted murder, one for allegedly shooting Burtman and another for allegedly firing on a group of patrons. Additionally, he is charged with two counts of first-degree assault for purposely causing bodily injury to Burtman and Surrett. Nadeau remains jailed while the charges against him are pending. As for Burtman, he continues to recover. In a January 31 date update posted on GoFundMe page supporting his recovery, Burtman shared he had undergone another small procedure and reached some small milestones in his treatment. "They removed the scaffolding from my head. Hooray," he wrote, adding that he was finally able to sleep on both sides again. He said the doctors also removed the jaw splint and all the wiring in my mouth, leaving his gums sore and his teeth no longer aligned, though further dental repair will take place once my jawbone is healed and ready. "I still smile pretty, not just as pretty before." In addition to the written update, the GoFundMe page included a recent photo of Burtman with a wrestling-style championship belt slung over his shoulder and a smile on his face. To date, the campaign has raised $182,000 toward its $200,000 goal. Individuals in emotional distress or contemplating suicide are urged to seek assistance. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 in Massachusetts, providing free and confidential support. contact the Lifeline by calling or texting 988 or visiting 988lifeline.org for online chat services. And that's important because then you can get help if you talk. It'd be surprising. Now, this next one is totally different, and we hope it's pleasant. It's from Bolton. Program to teach practical techniques, planting strategies. Bolton. Local gardeners eager to boost their harvest naturally can dig into the art of companion planting during an upcoming program at the Bolton Public Library. The program, titled Companion Planting and Design, will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 7th at the library, located at 738 Main Street. Hosted by Blackstone Valley Veggie Gardens, the presentation will explain how pairing certain plants together can improve garden health. The presentation will walk gardeners through practical techniques and planting strategies, said Kate Donovan, owner of Blackstone Valley Veggie Gardens and Garden Consultants. Participants will learn how to incorporate perennials and self-seeding plants, create a Zone 6A planting schedule, and boost their harvest through square foot gardening and the traditional Three Sisters method. That's interesting. The session will also cover herb integration, sample garden layouts, and common pairings, plant pairings to avoid. A question and answer will follow the program. The program is designed for home gardeners of all experience levels, from beginners planting their first raised bed to seasoned growers looking to refine their techniques, Donovan added. For more information or to register, visit the Bolton's Public Library's calendar on their website at theboltonlibrary.org. For more information on Blackstone Valley Veggie Gardens, visit their website at blackstonevalleyveggiegardens.org. And I'm really interested in what they were talking about is the Three Sisters method. I'll have to get online to see this. All right. Now, this is about civil rights. After a storied career, Jesse Jackson heads home to South Carolina and lies in state. This is from Columbia, South Carolina. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson Sr. was honored Monday in the state where he grew up under segregation with a hero's memorial, his flag-draped casket under the Capitol's rotunda, and thousands of people circling the statehouse grounds waiting to honor him. A horse-drawn caisson brought Jackson's body to the Capitol, and white-gloved state troopers brought the casket inside, where Jackson was the only second black person to lie in state. The service started with a rousing version of the black national anthem, "Lift Every Voice and Sing," that reverberated through the statehouse, a building that was partially destroyed in 1865 during the Civil War, which South Carolina started to keep slavery. Before the doors opened to the public, politicians and other guests remembered a man who grew up in Greenville and in 1960 led seven black high school students into the whites-only library branch. They sat down, quietly read books and magazines, and were arrested. And Jackson's civil rights career began. "Because of his efforts, I can sit where I am today," said Democratic U.S. Rep. Jim Clyburn, who has served 33 years in Congress and first met Jackson when they were on rival high school sports team in segregated South Carolina. They forged a long friendship through the civil rights struggle. Jackson died February 17th at the age of 84. He had a rare neurological disorder that affected his mobility and ability to speak in his later years. When the statehouse doors opened to the public, a line seven blocks long was waiting, People walked up to the second floor and were given a moment to pray or take a picture before a trooper in a dress uniform politely asked them to keep moving. Behind Jackson's casket, with his back turned, was a statue of former U.S. Vice President John C. Calhoun, a zealous defender of slavery. The South Carolina services are part of 2 weeks of events. It began with Jackson's body lying in response last week at his Rainbow Push Coalition Chicago headquarters. After South Carolina, Jackson will be returned to Chicago for a large celebration of life gathering at a megachurch and the final homecoming services at the Rainbow Push headquarters. Plans for a service in Washington, D.C. to honor him have been postponed. Jackson's family asked that he lie in honor at the United States Capitol Rotunda. House Speaker Mike Johnson's office declined the request because the space is typically reserved for former presidents, the military, and select officials. In some respects, South Carolina makes more sense than Washington, D.C., said Jackson's son, Jesse Jackson, Jr., thanking the people of the state for embracing his father as he pushed to make it a better place. Nationally and internationally, Jesse Jackson, Sr. advocated for the poor and underrepresented for voting rights, job opportunities, education, and health care. He scored diplomatic victories with world leaders. Through his Rainbow Push Coalition, he channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. He was the civil rights movement's torchbearer after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination and would run for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1984 and 1988. George Curtis drove nearly 3 hours from Greensboro, North Carolina. He is a North Carolina A&T University graduate, like Jackson, and that connection led them to meet several times. Curtis wore his hat with Jackson's name on it in support of one of his favorite causes. On the side, it said, "Keep hope alive. Vote." He was a great guy. His legacy will live on, but everybody has to vote. The way things are going, you have to vote. And as the side, don't forget to vote today in Lowell, Chelmsford Drakett. And I don't know about Groton, I'm not sure. Jackson was present in 2015 when the South Carolina House voted to finally remove the Confederate flag from the Capitol grounds. Several were placed there during the 1960s in opposition to the federal government's push for integration. South Carolina's longest-serving legislator found Jackson in the celebration. Democratic Representative Gilda Cobb Hunter said he pulled her aside. "It's great to take down the Confederate flag, but what about the Confederate agenda?" Cobb Hunter recalled him saying. "What I want people to remember is there is still much work to do." Jackson also pushed in 2003 for Greenville County to honor King by matching the federal holiday in his honor. It's not just black South Carolinians who owe Jackson a debt of gratitude. Anyone who enjoys the rewards of a rapidly growing state, thanks in part to manufacturers like luxury car maker BMW and airplane maker Boeing locating here, owes him, Greenville Mayor Knox White said. "Can you imagine a BMW or a Boeing would locate in segregated South Carolina?" "Of course not," White said. "He freed us all." The only other black man to lie in state at the South Carolina Capitol was State Senator Clementa Pinckney, who was shot and killed in the 2015 Charleston Church shooting that led to the removal of the Confederate flag from State House grounds. So we all can respect him very, very much. Let's see. Okay, today in history. All right. Now, in 1991. Wow, motorist Rodney King was severely beaten by Los Angeles police officers after a high-speed chase in a scene captured on amateur video that sparked outrage. The subsequent acquittal of four officers of felony assault and other charges in April 1992 triggered days of rioting and dozens of deaths in Los Angeles. Also on this date, go way back, 1845, Florida became a U.S. state. 1849, Congress established the U.S. Department of the Interior. 1863, President Abraham Lincoln signed the act creating the National Academy of Sciences. 1931, President Herbert Hoover signed a bill making the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. 1943, in London's East End, 173 people died in a crush of bodies at the Bethnal Green Tube Station, which was being used as a wartime air shelter. Wow. 1945, Allied troops fully secured the Philippine capital of Manila from Japanese forces during World War II after a month-long battle that had destroyed much of the city. 1969, Apollo 9 blasted off from Cape Kennedy on a mission to test NASA's lunar module. 2005, millionaire adventurer Steve Fawcett became the first person to fly a plane around the world solo without stopping or refueling, landing in Salina, Kansas, where he took off 67 hours earlier. And in 2022, OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma reached a nationwide settlement over its role in the opioid crisis, with the Sackler family members who own the company boosting their cash contribution to as much as $6 million in a deal intended to staunch a flood of lawsuits, anything to prevent them to have to pay more, do things. Savannah Guthrie returns to her mother's home. Today's show's host, Savannah Guthrie, and her sister returned to their mother's home outside Tucson on Monday in their first sighting at the house since Nancy Guthrie went missing a month ago. Wow, a whole month. In video captured by News Nation and Fox News Digital, the NBC anchor, her sister Anna Guthrie, and brother-in-law Tommaso Cioni can be seen walking arm-in-arm down the driveway, placing down yellow flowers and embracing each other in a tearful scene. The makeshift tribute at the edge of the property includes flowers, yellow ribbons, crosses, prayers, and a sign that read, "Let Nancy come home," and a statuette of an angel. Later on Monday, Savannah posted a photo of flowers at the tribute. "We feel the love and prayers from our neighbors, from the Tucson community, and from around the country," Guthrie wrote, ending the sentence with a heart emoji. "Please don't stop praying and hoping with us. Bring her home." Nancy Guthrie's children have previously appeared in videos in which they pleaded for their mother's return, most recently with the social media posting from Savannah Guthrie in which she said the family was offering a $1 million reward for information leading to the recovery of their mother. Nancy Guthrie was last seen at her home on January 31st and was reported missing the following day. Authorities believe the 84-year-old was kidnapped, abducted, or otherwise taken against her will. Drops of blood were found on the front porch, but authorities haven't publicly revealed much more evidence. Last week, Fox reported that a Ring camera about 2.5 miles from Guthrie's home had captured 12 vehicles passing around the time she went missing. The Pima County Sheriff's Department declined to say whether any of the passing vehicles in the videos were found to have been involved in Guthrie's disappearance. The agency said investigators are reviewing hundreds of hours of surveillance footage. Nancy Guthrie's home has been turned back over to her family, and the no trespassing sign have been posted on the property. All right, I think that this is time to say goodbye, but it's also a try to please remember to go out and vote today. I know the weather's going to be kind of crazy. I don't know. The snow is to begin early this afternoon and then possibly change to sleet. So if you can get out before that starts happening, good. All right. So goodbye and have a very good day.